This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Miwa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over, and it's always a treat to see Hanif Abdurraqib. It could be at someone else's event. It could be in one of our stores. I'm always so happy to see you, even if it's just on a screen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
There's this new book, There's Always This Year, on basketball and ascension. Before we get too deep into the book, I'm going to ask you to sort of walk us through Columbus now, where you live.
Yeah. Well, an interesting thing about Columbus now in 2024 is that it's a city that doesn't seem to know what it is aspiring to be. So it's aspiring to be the next, say, tech city or the next great food city. And what happens is, I think, that means that all these ambitions collapse upon each other, and the city becomes this kind of mirage of ambitions, oftentimes at the expense of people who have lived here and loved it for a long time. And so a good example of this is I live in a neighborhood called Bronzeville, which is kind of the last historically Black neighborhood in Columbus, or one of the last. Even on my street, to go down my street now, there are just more high-rise condos going up, and it's unclear who is going to live in them. But there's also not a grocery store, and that's a problem because there are a lot of elders who live in this community. And so it is effectively a food desert. And my thought is that there's not going to be a grocery store built until more people move out. You know, they're going to force people to move to a place to have their needs met, and then build the need when those people are gone to attract a new, quote unquote, younger and more hip crowd. So Columbus I still love it. I love it immensely. It still has all my favorite corners, all of my favorite people, at least most of my favorite people. It is my favorite place in the world, but it is not without its complications. It's still a very vibrant art city. It's still a city that is incredible at incubating and curating incredible artistic minds. Now, whether or not those minds stay in Columbus, that's another thing.
And we are going to get to the staying part, but I want to go back for a second and talk about Columbus when you were a kid, because you don't live all that far from where you grew up, right?
No, I live about like 5 to 7 minutes from where I grew up.
Okay.
And, you know, Columbus is by nature, everything's kind of like 10 to 20 minutes away from everywhere. But I live on the east side. I grew up on the east side. I grew up on a different version of the east side. But, you know, Columbus, as I grew up, was where I kind of learned that a city is just not one place. It's several different smaller cities kind of intertwining into each other to make a large city. So my block was its own city growing up. It was governed by its own set of rules. It had its own codes. It had its own language. And it felt very large to me, you know, to tell a child that even on a bike, there are boundaries. You can ride your bike to this boundary, and to have children adhering to that to some degree, of course. That means that within those boundaries, it's restricted geographically, but it is really, it leads to some abundant imagination. And within that imagination is where the city is built. You know, the city of the neighborhood, the city of the block is built. And so, you know, the forest across the street from my house, that became another city within the city. It became a clubhouse. In the basketball court was definitely a city within the city. And the church with the big hill where my friends and I would ride our bikes down, that was its own city. There are these things where the boundaries of a place can define it, and the maintenance of those boundaries can, of course, entice and beckon and seduce a place into violence. But from a childlike perspective, the boundaries of a place really require rigorous imagination in order to survive. That is the Columbus that I knew earliest, was the Columbus that I had imagined. Which is, in some ways, is why the reality of the city is a harsh one, because it was a playground of my imagination for so long, and then it wasn't.
This new book, basketball is a piece of it, but it's much more about, for me as the reader, memory and time and community and how place shapes us. I mean, the basketball parts are delightful, and you do structure it in a way so that we have, shall we say, markers of time that are familiar to anyone who's ever watched basketball, and I did really love that. But it's very much you. It's a mix of poetry and prose. It's really kind of sublime. I think that really is the word I'm looking for. And I'd heard that it had started with sort of based around LeBron James, but like you being you, it got bigger and deeper quite quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is I didn't really, much like A Little Devil in America, I mm-hmm. didn't really know what I was writing until I started writing it. This is a book I wanted to write years ago. I wanted to write this book after They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us. But I didn't really know how to pitch it to anyone. I didn't know how to write it myself. You know, I didn't know. And to be honest, I really didn't know. I took this to Ben Greenberg at Random House with a proposal that was essentially the essay on He Got Game about my dad that ended up in the book. And I think maybe a little bit of the section about LeBron James's hair. Mm-hmm. And that was all I had. And I told Ben, like, you know, like, I think this might get different as I go because I'm not really that I'm interested in LeBron James as someone who was defining Ohio and of my life, but I'm actually trying to get at something different here. These questions of time and mortality and memory and dreaming, mm-hmm. you know, to survive oneself, to say like, I genuinely did not believe or have a plan to be alive after the age of 25. And therefore every minute that I have outlived that impulse, it feels like it is steeped in gratitude, but also it's a bit frightening and it feels dreamlike. And it's hard to explain what that will look like on the page. It's hard to maybe put that into a book proposal. And so much like Little Devil, this kind of revealed itself to me as I wrote it. This was a bit of a cleaner process than Little Devil in terms of it being revelatory. But so much of this is the work of Maya Millett and Ben Greenberg, that my editors at Random House, who, you know, this is the first time I've ever done a second book with the same team. I've never had two books come out on the same press with the same team. And I think we just really figured it out. We just really figured out how to work. I mean, we worked well on Little Devil, obviously, but I think we unlocked something here. Editing is intimacy. It's a real level of intimacy. It is essentially, it's intimate even if it is you alone in your home. Because the work of editing essentially is looking into a mirror or having a mirror held to you and having someone, even if that someone is yourself, point out all the potentially displeasing things about that reflection, right? Especially when you're writing with the self at the center. To build this intimate relationship with Maya and Ben, it was seamless because the way this book was, you know, this book, its first draft was like, I'd have to fact, I mean, I think it was like 117,000 words or something. Mm-hmm. And we ended it, you know, ended at maybe like 90,000. And so that doesn't, and it happened just so smooth. And that doesn't happen if you don't have a relationship, an editorial relationship that's really thoughtful.
I feel like with you too, and I've read you across your different imprints and different projects and different editorial teams and whatnot. It also feels like you are always interrogating, albeit politely, interrogating mythology.
Yeah.
And that that's always the starting point. Where regardless of where we end up, whether we're talking music or film or our culture and our society, where we are, we always start with the mythology. And that's whether it's family or place or, in this case, sports. But I mean, I think about your music criticism. And it's always, there's always a lot of love, you know, don't misunderstand me. But in order to be intimate with yourself and the work and everything else, you have to have this starting point. And I think it happens in your poetry too, or at least I feel like it does. I mean, certainly in this book, the poems that are in this book, without a doubt, there is an absolute, like, here's the starting point. This is what we've been told. And it's kind of wrong. And we're going to go from there. So in terms of the structure of this book, the essays and, you know, you have sort of walked us through the editing process. But in terms of the structure, are you pulling pieces that had been written over time and then figuring out how they work together? Because this is a really seamless read. And it's not just because you have the great time markers and all of that, but I'm watching you evolve on the page in a way that I don't necessarily feel like I've seen in earlier work.
That's really kind. Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think it's because this is the first book that nothing in this book had been previously published. It was all kind of, well, except for one thing, the White Man Can't Jump essay had been previously published in Paris Review, and I kind of wrote mm-hmm. through it differently. But I was figuring it all out in real time. And the book was, it's comforting to hear that it's seamless. That too is, you know, the book was once backwards, timeline-wise. It flipped, it once began in 2016 because I was trying to do this kind of like unraveling of the myth of what it is to be a champion. But then I realized that was one thing too many. And I think I went into this book saying, I just really want to go for it. I want to do something. I'm obviously a large music fan, and I really admire when a band, like let's say Fleetwood Mac in between Rumours and Tusk, right? If Fleetwood Mac wanted to, they could have just made Rumours too, and it would have been, people would have loved it. They would have been happy with that, and it would have sold a trillion copies again. And I think everything I've written since They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us is me being aware of the fact that I could just write They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us Part 2. I could do that in like 2 weeks, and Random House would, you know, be satisfied at least, and they would take it and it would do okay. But I really admire artists who just decide to every time out say, well, I'm going to go for it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that my mentality was, I'm going to make the hardest throw possible. But then when Ben and Maya and I read through the book in its kind of inverted state, we were kind of like, no, let's flip it around. And then you can really kind of play with this. You can play with mythology in 4 different ways. Instead of asking people to track through, when it was in its kind of reverse form, there was a lot of having to backtrack. There was a lot of reading and not in that pleasureful way where you're like, oh, this image is coming back to life. It was like, I lost a story and now I need to go back and refine the story. Even just the act of flipping it around and then segmenting the chapters or segmenting the quarters meant that, oh, I can play with 4 different types of mythology, or technically 3 because 2 of them are geographical, city and city, but play with those in a real way. And not even, sometimes it is what we've been told is not what the reality is. But sometimes it's just like, there's something even more miraculous or beyond what we know. And I want to get there. And even if I don't get there in the work, I want to lay down a blueprint so that I can perhaps have this eternal obsession with getting there, however long it takes, even if I don't come to the conclusion in this product of text.
Witness is a big piece of the work you do. Bearing witness, witnessing other people witnessing. And one of the things you say in this book is, you know, what does it mean to be a witness in a country that really wants to forget? Have you changed the way you see the role of the witness and see yourself as a witness? I mean, because they're not necessarily exactly aligned, but having written this book now, has that changed for you?
I think so. I mean, broadly, I've always been a bit skeptical of the utility in inactive witnessing. I think to bear witness should open at least some doorway to action. But I also think that, you know, some folks are satisfied with witness as an inactive, kind of an inactive prompt, where you bear witness to something, but then you are just a consumer. There's a difference between witness and consumption, I think. And I think what the difference is one leaves you kind of satiated, but not moving towards anything. And the other opens up a door to action. But I also think I'm a romantic by design. You know, I think I do know that there are those who would say my work is maybe cynical, which it can be it's to some degree, but I actually don't think romanticism and cynicism are at odds. I am cynical of the landscapes upon which love can occur, but I do very much believe that love can occur upon them no matter what. And I do think that to bear witness is a romantic action too. And I think there is romance in a somewhat stagnant witness. To slow down time, for example. To slow down time is an action, right? So to say, I'm bearing witness and I want to slow this moment down, and at least on the page, I am capable of doing that for you, the reader, and for myself. That is an action that I think satisfies a romantic witness for me, a moment of romantic witness. So I think there are 2 things at play in this book. You know, there's that scene where I kind of retrace the Dick Snyder shot multiple times. And it's because I've watched that shot a million times. You know, I've just watched it on YouTube so many times. And that obsession. And I remember when writing this book and watching that shot, I have multiple monitors on because I'm that kind of person, I suppose. I had that shot on this monitor, on this far monitor here. And I had it paused and I looked over and it was that exact thing where I looked and I thought the ball looks like the sun setting against a blue sky. And I thought I would have never, without careful, thoughtful, even sometimes accidental, because that was legitimately just like I paused it at a point. Even accidental witness done out of care can lead to some really romantic inquiry. And that inquiry can show itself on the page really well.
I think part of that too, of being a witness, an active witness, is a form of intimacy, right? And it brings us back to that original kind of starting point where you have to be able to drop your guard, which it's hard enough for anyone in society now to feel like they can actually be vulnerable and intimate. But you're also you. There are lots of folks who have feelings about the work you do.
Yeah.
There are lots of people who choose to interact with your work in different ways. But a writer, I mean, just by the sheer act of writing, it is an act of intimacy, right? Like it is a thing that it's a mechanism for engaging with the world. And I think if we're pretending that reading and writing are not acts of intimacy, that they're just things that you do because it's a thing to do, I think we're sort of missing the point.
Yeah. I mean, for me, reading, I suppose I think reading is just as intimate for me, if not more so.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up reading. My mother would put books in my hand and my father would put books in my hand that I was certainly too young for. I saw this like funny, perhaps tweet or Instagram post from someone that was like, I wish there was more. Or there's something like, I'm so happy that there's more YA for young Black kids now, because I read Waiting to Exhale when I was like 7 or whatever. And that was for real me. Like, I read Waiting to Exhale when I was really young. And I remember reading like Women of Brewster Place when I was 11 or so. What Gloria Naylor is able to do in that book, talk about, you know, the stakes of presenting a geography wherein imagination both flourishes and suffers. Women of Brewster Place is very much embedded in There's Always This Year. I went back and read it during the writing of this book, because that was a book I read as a kid that I think taught me about the intimacy of a constrained place, for better or worse. And so I think reading is an intimate act, but I also think that what I am attempting to do in my work is present a version of myself that is steeped in gratitude for having survived and is also immensely aware of the fact that I don't have an infinite amount of time. And that for me turns me towards a vulnerability, because I am not necessarily racing against an invisible clock, but I am aware of the clock. And I'm aware that I will never have enough time to say everything I would like to say to everyone I'd like to say it to. I will never have enough time to be forgiven by everyone who I would like to be forgiven by. I'll perhaps not ever have enough time to offer forgiveness to the people who I should perhaps offer forgiveness to. And so in the middle there, I'm attempting to close these gaps that will be infinite by being sort of fluorescently vulnerable on the page. You know, I've talked about perhaps like writing about my father very lovingly in a way that I perhaps could not as easily express to him in real life. For me, the vulnerability I'm offering on the page is attempting to close some gaps between what I don't know if I deem them as failures, but perhaps just the realities of our living. There is never going to be enough time to love everyone who might love us, because we are not going to come across everyone who might love us. And the very knowing of that means that I am reaching for an absence, perhaps, or I'm reaching for the knowing of that absence, and not even looking for people to, I'm not looking for people to love me back who I don't know, but I'm saying that I, understanding that I have a deep capacity for love that will not be fulfilled in my lifetime, I have to place it somewhere, and I'm placing it in language and I'm placing it on the page.
A big piece of this book too is sort of this ongoing set of departures and returns. I mean, even you yourself left Columbus for a couple of years. You were on the East Coast and you went back to Columbus. I mean, certainly LeBron leaving Cleveland, coming back to Cleveland, you know, he's never really left Akron as sort of a spiritual home. But this idea that we have that you've got to leave your hometown behind in order to be successful, right? And you talk about this sort of directly in the subtitle of the book. You know, this idea that you have to be willing to put things behind you. And it's like, well, why should we have to make that choice?
Yeah.
Right? Why should we have to leave? I mean, Columbus agrees with you. I mean, living there has been a very nice experience. But I love that. Like, why should you have to run to someplace like New York or Los Angeles or Chicago or Dallas or whatnot? Why can't you just be in that place? And I'm watching you interrogate that. And certainly using sports, right? Like, there, I will be perfectly honest, I don't follow college basketball. So there was some stuff where I had to go Google straight up.
Of course.
I will own it. Yeah. I had to go Google some stuff. But this idea that, and you talk about this, where it's just kind of like, you know, sports allows us to talk about place in terms of miracles and generosity and community and all of these things. And I love the connection, but you're doing more than just talking about sports, right? Like,
yeah.
How much of this is you interrogating masculinity and how we view masculinity in our societies and our culture? And because I think success can mean different things broken down by gender still, which is weird in 2024, but I do think that happens.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I think there are some things I was doing during writing Go Ahead in the Rain where I was trying to knock on the door of complicating relationships between masculinity and affection. And it's funny, I mentioned my father, and I mentioned my father in part because, you know, you write a book and you think it's about these container of things that you've decided on. Right. And then you start hearing from other people. And so many people were like, oh man, you know, people who had read all of my work, you know, all my books, they're like, man, this is, you know, the first time you've written extensively about your dad, you know, and like your relationship with your dad. And so I think even subconsciously, I'm trying to reckon with and reconcile in the book both the consequences of the boy slash young man I was on the realities of the man I am now and how I see that reflected in a man who has been vital in my life, you know, for my whole life and whatever our, you know, our shared intersections and complications and joys may be. And so, yeah, there's some of that unraveling. And also it's an unraveling of what it means to quote unquote make it. And that is a very gendered question as well, right? And for me, you know, it's not just about like who stays and who leaves, but when we talk about like what it means to leave and make it somewhere else, I think it requires unraveling what making it means. And sometimes I think unraveling what making it means means to unravel who you are and where you're coming from. For me, you know, when I was unhoused, making it meant just having enough money to get enough food for a couple of days. You know, if I had enough money to get like some McDonald's dollar menu stuff for a couple of days, that was making it. And I didn't have to go anywhere to do that. I could do that right where I was. But, you know, my niece is a very good basketball player. I'm actually going to see her play in the state championship tomorrow in Indiana. It's been so interesting to hear my brother kind of talk about, she's a junior, she's 16. And to hear her talk about this kind of futurescaping plan of, you know, well, the WNBA is maybe on the table, but she wants to be a sports journalist because she's deeply aware that WNBA players aren't compensated well enough. And so there's a question of, even in this sport that she loves deeply, the question of making it is divided into, can you make it? Can you actually survive while playing at the highest level that is afforded to you in the United States, at least? These are complications that like, it's hard for me to consider.
Right.
In real life, not on the page, just like in real life. But yeah, I mean, the book is also, it's just orbiting that grand question of what it means to make it. And if I am honest about what it means to make it, then I can be directly more honest about staying versus leaving.
And what you're saying, too, is making me think of another line from the book where you're talking about home isn't a choice that one makes. Home is a set of circumstances.
Sure.
Success is a set of circumstances, right? Yeah. Making it is a set of circumstances. Like I think it would really benefit all of us as a society and as a culture if we were to think about more about what those circumstances mean. I mean, we've ascribed so much morality to circumstance and systems.
Of course. Yeah.
And part of what I'm hoping happens with readers of There's Always Next Year is that we might actually pull in some people who have not necessarily been in a position to have these kinds of conversations or ask these kinds of questions. And we might be able to do it because there's a little bit of basketball and
yeah.
a little bit of movies and a little bit of music. I added yeah. some stuff to I have this sort of epic playlist going because it's just easier to add stuff to the playlist.
Right. You know,
I'd gone back to They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us because it had been a minute since I'd read it. And there's a new fifth year anniversary edition that came out. And I wanted to play a little bit. But then I find myself adding songs by Future and Mobb Deep
sure.
and My Chemical
yeah.
Romance. And it's like, oh, here's this whole bit of Hanif in my playlist.
Yeah.
And it was kind of fun walking to work, listening to it because it's such a wild mix. I mean, there was a little Fleetwood Mac in there. And I love the way you approach influence and pulling from all of these disparate places, right? Like, I just read anything I see your byline attached to because I'm like, I have no idea where it's going to go. I'm going to have fun.
Yeah.
I am going to end up asking questions that I might not have been prepared to ask myself. And you have this riff in the new book about hustling, and you connect it to intimacy, and you connect it to nostalgia. Suddenly, I'm thinking about a hustle in a totally different way. You're talking about hustling and how, well, it's not an intimate act, but there's a layer of intimacy.
Oh, for sure.
To it. And I'm thinking, right, because you get hustled because you want to be part of something that's bigger than you. You want to belong. You want to, whatever that thing is, right? You get taken in because you want to believe.
Yeah. And if you are a hustler, it requires a level of knowing.
Yeah.
It requires a level. The best hustlers are people who very quickly can know how they can find an entry point into someone, who can pinpoint what someone's desires may be, pinpoint where someone feels they are lacking emotionally or from a desire standpoint, and then take advantage of that. And I have to say this in the book, I fall somewhere in the middle. I don't praise all hustles, perhaps, but I do admire a hustler to some degree.
I think we as a culture certainly admire hustlers.
Yeah. Well, depending on who they are, depending on who's doing the hustling.
Right, right. Yeah. But you do have this line, nostalgia is a relentless hustler. I love this line. I think this line is it just captures everything, because nostalgia, right, is one of those things you can either sort of appreciate and enjoy. And, you know, we all have fond memories of sort of where we grew up, or, you know, ice cream in the summer or whatever. And then nostalgia can be weaponized.
Of course. I think nostalgia requires a critical lens. It requires, mm-hmm. The critical lens is the engine of nostalgia.
Right.
Because if you are to talk about witness and being an active witness, nostalgia in an inactive state, nostalgia is simply sitting around and saying, wow, the good old days, right. The good old days. And that might, for me, I can't speak for everybody else, that might be good for the porch, but that's not really good for the work. And I think I'm really trying to differentiate, as someone who is kind of a nostalgist to a degree, to a very high degree, perhaps running through my work, in that process, I'm really trying to differentiate between a porch conversation and a page conversation. Because I have no problem sitting on a porch with my friends and being like, man, you know, the good old days on the basketball court, whatever. And we can laugh and we can joke. But to actually move that from the porch to the page means that I have to be both accountable to myself and accountable to the fact that me and my homies aren't the only people going to be reading that on the page. Other people are going to be reading that on the page, and they have to get something more from it than this kind of whimsical nostalgizing that does not have a critical lens as its engine.
Yeah, I still really love the image, though, of nostalgia as a relentless hunt. Like, it just plays us. It plays us and it plays us and it plays us, even when we don't think it is. And that's just so human. I mean, I really, I'm very attached to this line.
Thank you.
But for you, you're flipping back and forth between essay and criticism, which are not necessarily the same thing, or you're flipping between poetry and essay and criticism and all of these different forms. And I'm wondering how much the material dictates the form and how much the form dictates the material, because you're so fluid when you move between them that it's, again, it goes back to being seamless, but it's not the easiest thing to do.
Thank you. Yeah, I think the form, for me, it's always the material dictates form, dictates shape. You know, there's I think this book has the most kind of experimentation in terms of how much shows up in the book in terms of range of form and shape and all that.
Mm-hmm.
All that's dictated by what the material is asking. Sometimes sonically too, you know, what sound is demanding, but a lot of that's all, it's all going to be dictated by the material and the kind of sub-material. Because a lot of it is me, genuinely, the draft phase for me is kind of, everything is kind of being revealed as I go. I'm genuinely entering several rooms and I'm feeling around for a light switch, and then I find it, and then I find another door where the lights are off, and I have to feel around for a light switch. And that process is really enlivening for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that the material is kind of being shaped as I go. The material reply, you know, I turn on the light switch, and then the material is requiring the room to look a certain way before I move on to the next room. That's really a blessing in the draft phase, to have these moments of revelation like that.
You mentioned Gloria Naylor and the women of Brewster Place as an influence on this book. And I know you pull from so many different places when it comes for inspiration, but can we talk more about a few writers? I mean, Toni Morrison, obviously, someone who's always been near and dear to your work, but who else might be in there?
Well, Morrison's definitely in there in a very wild way. There's that scene that opens up the fourth quarter where I'm kind of walking down downtown Cleveland. That's just straight up ripped from Jazz.
Yep.
Like, that's from that scene in Jazz where it's like, I love this city, and the slant light slants over the, you know, that's pure, that's straight up Morrison. Maggie's in it. Maggie Nelson, who for me is like the greatest writer we have around kind of Shameless obsession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know people turn to Bluettes, and of course, because I think that is maybe a great work on obsession, mm-hmm. but all of her work is that, you know, On Freedom was that, you know, it was like the new thing is that, you know, the new Maggie Nelson book is that. And so I really rely on Maggie as a kind of lighthouse to stay in a place until it's uncomfortable and then stay beyond the discomfort. You know, what I love about Bluettes is that that book is a conversation. It's almost like a conversation with herself that the reader is just bearing witness to. Because mm-hmm. so much of that is internal. So much of it is her kind of like, I am aware that I have stayed in this place too long and it's uncomfortable even for me, but we're going to keep going. And so I needed that. There's a whole lot of Virginia Hamilton, another Ohioan who wrote The People Could Fly, who's, mm-hmm. who's also referenced in the book, because there's, I think like there's some fable and fairy tale in the book too, that I think is inspired by Virginia Hamilton. There's Walter Dean Myers, who the book Hoops was the first book about basketball I ever read that I really loved. And so I think Walter Dean Myers is kind of embedded in there. There's, you know, in terms of direct contemporary peers, there's a bit of Jason Reynolds,
yeah.
who is someone I love because of how effectively he can just slow down a moment. You know, I forget which book it is of his that has that scene where it's like he's just kind of deconstructing a school bus. I think it's maybe This Way Up. It's like deconstructing a school bus and giving all these like sub definitions for what a school bus is. That is happening in this book. Like there's something I lifted straight from that in a way. Mm-hmm. Gabrielle, the poet Gabrielle Cavalcaresi, who is also in these kind of the moments in the book that feel more colorful, where images may be driving more than anything else. That's definitely Gabby. You know, it's just littered with all these kind of these influences. There's to some level of musical influence. Brian Wilson's in the book. I mean, I was listening to the Pet Sounds sessions really religiously and relentlessly when working on this book. And I love the Pet Sounds sessions so much. I love Pet Sounds as an album. I think that's, you know, there are rare albums in the American music canon where I am like, this is exactly as good as everyone says it is. Mm-hmm. And Pet Sounds, you know, Pet Sounds to me is truly one of those ones. And the Pet Sounds sessions is so informative for me as a creative person, because I don't know if you or people listening will notice, but that album was called Pet Sounds because Brian Wilson was literally hearing differently. His ears were aligned differently due to like a head injury he had. So he was hearing the world differently than everyone else. He brought in some of the best session musicians alive at that time. And he had to explain to them what he was hearing, even though they could not hear it that way. And they just had to trust him. And so there are these points in the Pet Sounds sessions where he's like making noises with his mouth that are really indecipherable to any instrument that could be played at that point. And people were just, they were taking the leap with them until something got formed, until something was unlocked. And there's actually, that was so vital to this creative process, because there was so much of this in the draft phase where I was straight up saying to myself, I've dreamed this, I've seen it, I've seen this book come to life, and I actually just cannot render the dream clearly. And that doesn't mean I'm failing. It just means that I have to convince my waking self to get a little bit closer to what my dream state has experienced. And that just takes a continuous leap of faith and a lot of rewrites and all these things. And so the Pet Sound Sessions is a really great, it's a text. It's like a text on editing. So that's in there. I think Tracy Chapman is always present in my work. I adore her writing, and she's present in my work. So yeah, it's I mean, I could keep going. It's just a massive, massive list. But truly Gloria Naylor and you know, Morrison always, but I think Morrison specifically in this book, I mean, there's stuff that I really just kind of, I don't know if I like straight up stole it or whatever, but there's stuff that is really like mirroring Jazz.
I had just reread Jazz prepping for a different conversation, but I just reread it in December. So when I sat down to prep for this, I was kind of like, I feel like I've been here more, you know, as an homage, not certainly. But I also had a moment of the opening of Another Country as Rufus is sort of cruising through Times Square and doing his thing. And I mean, and that's, you know, everyone has feelings about Another Country, but it's a book that I remain very fond of.
Do people not like Another Country? Do people not like that?
There are some people who feel like it's flabby towards the end. The kinetic energy of that book is not something that I'm going to be picky about. To me, the experience of that book is more important than sort of, I'm still very happy with it. But I love the movement that happens with you when I'm reading you on the page. And I never feel like I'm in a static sort of, I don't know. I mean, I'm watching you on Zoom and you're not like bouncing up and down. It's not like you're not sitting still, but there's an energy to you on the page that I don't get with every writer. And, you know, I feel that way about Morrison in many ways. I certainly feel that way about Baldwin. And I think being able to connect with that is kind of important to understanding you.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
I think I'm pretty fortunate that my brain just doesn't stay in one place for very long.
Mm-hmm.
And so it allows me these kind of, I think this book is maybe the greatest representation of what my brain is actually like, because of how quickly it is attempting to move through a lot of things and just hope for the best. Yeah, I think this relies on a lot of trust, you know? This book, more than any other, I think has relied on, you know, I need to trust to surrender and trust that readers will be able to follow me. You know, I do think, I mean, at this point, it's no secret, I'm very inspired by Toni Morrison and Baldwin to a degree. And Morrison is, not, I think, only the greatest writer of all time, but of course, that means that to me, she's the greatest Ohioan who's ever lived. It seems to me that there's an imagination that comes from a slightly more still. And I'm not saying that, it's not like we grew up on farms and whatnot. I mean, some people out here do, but some people everywhere do, in New York State, they do. But I'm saying that there is a slight stillness to my childhood. And I know Miss Morrison's talking about a kind of stillness that existed in her youth at times that leads to this kind of brain activity that I think everything is always traveling towards each other. So there's a lot of things happening in my head at any given time, perhaps too much, but everything feels like it's traveling towards something. And it just requires movement that's not painful or agonizing. It's playful. It's an opportunity for play. It's a Rubik's Cube. You know, essentially, it's kind of working on a Rubik's Cube.
I mean, for me, when I'm reading you too, it feels a little bit like you're always in conversation, right? Like there's a cadence to conversation. There's a musicality to conversation. There's a flow to conversation, but you're always in conversation with the art that came before or the music that's happening now, or even a sports play that I may have had to go Google. And certainly an ad I had to go Google. I was like, I don't remember that. I tend not to remember ads except for like the Apple ad in 1984.
Wait, is it the Nike commercial?
Yeah, it is from 2014. And I had
no
to
one,
go.
But you're not alone in that. No one
really
remembers that. And I feel like, so I just did a reading in Ohio where I played it. I played that ad on a projector before I read that part.
Okay.
And this was a room of like 150 Ohioans, and no one remembered. Maybe one person remembered. No one remembered it because it only got played maybe once. It got played that one time and then never again. So, I remember it, but I also think part of me writing that stretch of text was like, I would probably not remember this had I not been in Connecticut and been longing for home. I don't think I would have actually remembered that commercial. So you were not alone there. I think most people do not remember that.
And my first thought was, wow, LeBron looks so young.
So young.
He looks so young. You can sort of see the echo of, the guy we get to watch play now. But, and also, this is going to be totally weird for a second, but I had misremembered what his first Sports Illustrated photo was. And, so I'm digging around. Luckily, yay, Google. But I found it. I remembered a photo of him in the air. Not necessarily dunking, but like really just flying through the air. A little Jordan-esque, right? I mean, and he's a teenager and everyone's talking about this 15-year-old, right? And no, that's not the photo at all. It's a great photo.
Great photo.
But it's like a full face shot. And I was like, how did I? And so walking through your memory, right? Having you be a tour guide through your memory and your experience and your understanding of place and everything else just took me into spaces that I wasn't expecting to go. I mean, what am I doing on the Sports Illustrated archive, digging up jackets, but
right.
or digging up magazine covers?
Yeah.
But that's, we're talking about collective memory, right? Or you're talking about collective memory. You're talking about all of the stuff that shapes us.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the hope is that people, in all my work, the hope is that people exit the page to seek out something that they can then have their own relationship with. I think nostalgia in a state of activity is collective. It's a collective practice. Because sure, many of us have memories. Many of our good old days are not the same as other people's good old days. But if I say, here is an object from a point where we were both certainly alive, you and I, reader, and I am going to present the object to you, and you perhaps will seek it out and then have your own unique relationship with it. That is collectively building a nostalgia bridge that we can all kind of meet upon. And that's useful, I think. That is useful for the maintaining of memory in a way that is active.
The We Are the World version of the Cleveland video, maybe I didn't need to hit play on that, but I did share it a lot with some folks. But again, that's just speaking to the larger piece. And I did laugh.
It's absurd, right? It's an absurd. That part almost got trimmed from the book because I was like, it's not bad writing or whatever, but I was like, this is such a ridiculous thing.
Right.
I had this in that same section. I had this whole thing about the Wright brothers that ended up getting mm-hmm. trimmed because it was okay. a little too meandering, but it was kind of between, not that it was like a one for one, but it was like one of these two things is taking us a little too far off track in the We Are the World bit stayed because I was able to write it in a way that was a little more seamless, but I'm glad that it will send people to that video, but it is completely absurd.
It was wild. And I will honestly say I did not finish watching it. The ad finish watching, but the We Are the World Cleveland video,
It's too long. It's too long of a thing. It's way too long.
But I mercilessly sent it on to some folks and I didn't even explain. I just said, I'm doing homework. Click. The group chat had a moment with me. They were not happy with me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did this book surprise you at all? I know you've said that none of this material really appeared in print prior, except for the one piece that had a different form in the Paris Review. I sort of think of that as maybe an incubator. But
sure.
Did this surprise you?
Oh, yeah. This is the most surprising book I've ever written. And I think it was also kind of, but there are parts of it where I'm not sure how I got to the places I got to. Not because I'm uniquely good, but because I think I was guided by, I had dreamed of this book for so long. And I really think I was guided by that dreaming more than actual, which is why the first draft was so overwritten, you know, which is why the first draft was just on like a word count level was so overwritten, because I was just guided by this kind of wild dreaming. And so there were days, I mean, when I'm in book mode, I'm pretty rigorous. I write 3,000 words a day, 4 days a week for about 2.5 months. And there were some days where I would get to the end of the day and look at what I'd written and kind of be like, well, I remember this part and this part, but I feel like I was really just on a roll and kind of, maybe it's like the Marvin Gaye, you know, there's that experience where Marvin Gaye was making What's Going On and he insisted that to Smokey Robinson that the album was being written by God or whatever. I don't think that I would not ascribe that to this experience. It's not a one for one, but there were these moments of, I mean, that whole scene that opens quarter four, because that was one of the first things I wrote since the book was initially backwards, the whole scene of me walking through downtown Cleveland.
Yep.
I don't know if I remember writing the bones of that, but I really, that some of that stuff just kind of filled in from pure memory. The scene of me watching the Nike ad, because that was such an emotional experience for me. A lot of that was just like heart first writing that I don't think it crystallized a bit more through editing. It became a bit more cerebral. But so much of the book that was surprising for me was that it was just very heart first instead of my usual process, which is very analytic first or brain first or trying to unravel several things first. There were parts of this that were just really led by feeling. And that's so unlike me. I think that is not unlike my living, but it is unlike my writing practice. And I think for the first time in ever, my living intertwined with my writing practice in a way that served the book. You know, I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine another writing process like this. I know that I will, I mean, hopefully write another book, but I don't know. There was no process like this. I mean, there was no writing process like this. There was no editing process like this. It just felt like nothing else. And I won't say that there were definitely moments where it was challenging, but the challenge was exciting to get to. You know, it was one of those things where it was like, this is hard work, but what a blessing that I get to do it.
It sounds like it was a full body process. And years ago, a writer said to me, well, I can sit at my desk for a really long time because I work out a lot. and he was saying, well, you know, Tuesdays are leg days. And I was like, really? And I hadn't thought about it. But listening to you describe that and to lead with your heart, like your whole body has to be present in a way that sometimes it's really nice to be analytical and just go scratch, scratch, scratch. Here's the thing. And not have to feel everything that you're feeling as you're putting this out in the world.
I did like feeling everything this time around. There have been times where I've been more averse to that. But this was a time where I think I chased that. I chased the ability to feel everything.
I mean, looking back at the first book, They Can't Kill Us Unless They Kill Us, I felt like there was a reserve there. And that's partially youth. I think. And that was also partially you getting established. I feel like, yeah. I mean, I know it was your first book, but I feel like I had seen your byline. Like I knew when the book was coming out, I'd seen your byline before. I had read plenty of the pieces, not all, but I'd read plenty of stuff. And then it sort of felt like, wait, everything happened at once, sure, in a way. But I feel like I know more of you with this book than I would have with any of the previous books. And it's not like you're not living your life and doing your thing. It's just, I feel like you were open in a way that would have been really difficult for you previously.
I think so. I mean, look, I'm proud of They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us. Mm-hmm. That book has touched a lot of people. I also think that there's a way that that book defines a part of my career, and I hope that, mm-hmm, it does not define the whole of my career, because, yeah, I've evolved so much from that. And I think you're right. And some of that evolution is understanding the performance of vulnerability versus actually putting myself in a position to honor a vulnerable approach and to put real risk into vulnerability, which I think this book is attempting to do. Because I don't know. I mean, I think I was, with They Can't Kill Us Till They Kill Us, I was not, even though that book was written in a massive time of crisis and written in a really crisis-filled era and written in a way that was deeply steeped in that crisis, I think I still had a reality of maybe I'll get another book. Ever since then, I have to treat every book as though it is the last book. Therefore, it will be, I'm not going to be one of those writers where when I die, you're going to find my papers and that's it, you know. Even if I were to die unexpectedly, there's going to be nothing you will find except maybe notes in my group chat, you know? So to know that means that every book could be my last thing. And so therefore it needs to be my best thing, and it needs to be better than what was before it. Or I need to at least try to make a throw that's more difficult and more challenging than the one before it. And with this book, I needed to be, I kept asking myself, well, what have I been afraid of? What have I been afraid of in the work? What have I not wanted to approach? And how can I at least get closer to what I'm afraid of and maybe look into it a bit, look it in the eye and see if I can be a little bit brave around it and see how that bravery manifests itself on the page. And so I think this is maybe the bravest book I've ever written, because it was the one where I was really considering my fears and attempting to look directly at them.
What were you most afraid of when you sort of thought about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm beyond the age my father was when he had me, and in a couple of years, I'll be beyond the age my mother was when she died.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm kind of dealing with time and mortality in a very real way. And I mean, I mentioned early on, you know, to say, okay, I did not think I was going to live past age 25, and now to be 15 years past that point. That, for many of us who have struggled with this kind of these questions of wanting to be here or alive and here, to survive these moments where that seems flimsy, I think people expect only gratitude to be the answer. And yes, gratitude, sure. But there's also a lot of fear and uncertainty. And it is almost like you're living an entirely different life. You know, so it's like I'm not saying that I'm a 15-year-old, but I am saying that, you know, I'm maybe scared to come to terms with the fact that I have chosen and I have to continually choose to be here. And that means that I have to take responsibility for being here in a really tangible way, and not just be satisfied with the fact that I woke up today and said, well, I'd like to be alive again. That is satisfying in some ways, but there's real fear that I feel about having to live up to the expectation of having survived the worst impulses of myself. And I don't know if I'll ever come to terms with that. I don't know if I'll ever conquer that fear. But it was good to write a book where I'm staring at time directly in a very literal sense. You know, the book is structured in that way in a very literal sense, because I wanted to look directly at the descent of time. That placed an urgency in me, in both my writing process, but in any kind of fear or anxiety I might have had to not say something that I otherwise would have said if I would convince myself that I had infinite time to say it. And so the book is structured. Yeah, I know the book is structured like a basketball game, and that's cool. I think that that is cool and fun and all that, but it also served a very practical purpose for me. I wanted to look directly at a clock that was constantly descending.
It really works. I want to flip back for a second, though. You were talking about the performance of vulnerability, which made me think the performance of intimacy, right? The performance of however we get through our lives, right? And being able to say, okay, that is a performance. I mean, sports obviously perform like performance at its finest, right?
Yeah.
And this idea that somehow we're all just kind of not necessarily sleepwalking, right? But you do this also, you know, you started Little Devil in America with the idea that you were going to interrogate performance. And yes, you do, but also you flip it into something else as a celebration of. And I think it's just really good for us to think about where that line falls, right?
Yeah.
Between performance and gratitude and authenticity. Like, authenticity is hard. And it's scary.
Yeah.
It can be really scary. And I'm so excited for readers to get their hands on the new book. I really, 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 nostalgia is indeed a relentless hunter, and it is always really good to see you, Hanif. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you for this podcast too. I listen when I can. You know, I really love the conversation you have with Ann Patchett. You know, I'm such a big fan of hers, and you know, and you have one with Angie Kim that I really loved as well. With that, like, brought me to get that book. I think Happiness Falls, I think it is.
Yep.
So yeah, I really appreciate the work you do to kind of, you know, like, I'm sometimes out of the loop when it comes to book stuff. And so, not that I don't care, it's just like so much stuff that happens right at once. And so I've gotten a lot of books off this podcast that I've really enjoyed. So thank you for hosting it.
Well, thank you, because I get a lot of music from you. Straight up, like, you know, I'm not in the car as much as I used to be. So music, I have to go, you know, to the sources. And you are absolutely one of my sources. So thank you for that. And it's always great to see you.
Always good to see you.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.